Okay. Thanks very much. Well, without further ado, to say it gives me great privilege to introduce our next speaker is an understatement. And Clancy is going to be celebrating 46 years of sobriety on the 31st of October. And we've also got Clancy a little cakelet, and it reads, "To Clancy, happy 46th birthday, love from the reunion," and the sobriety date, 31st of the 10th, 58. And without further ado, please give a warm Bristol reunion welcome to Clancy.
My name is Clancy Immeslin. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I feel kind of sad. I got the same size cake as she did. Nice to see you newer people staying active. But I'm kind of a sentimentalist, I guess. I'm maybe as corny and I'm a sentimentalist tonight. And I'm maybe a softy. I'm getting old, soft in my old age. But I was thinking tonight, if I had one day left to live, if somebody told me I had one day left to live, I think I'd like to, I'd maybe ask them if they could read to me the announcements they read before the meeting tonight. It would make that last day seem like forever. But I am glad to be here. I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I like to say. Glad to be back in Bristol. Glad to see a lot of friends. We were talking this afternoon. We had us sitting around drinking coffee and talking over at the hotel about something that seems to be of general interest to people, and that is that why some people seem to be able to come here and not have to do what other people have to do. And this seems strange. And I've given that some thought over the years. I've taught to people. And it's become clear that, I think it is quite clear, that there seem to be different types of alcoholics. There never, I don't know if there are any delineated anywhere or put down anywhere, but there seems to be a type of alcoholic that by any measurement is an alcoholic, but something dramatic happens, something that really threatens their security. Maybe they lose their family, or they lose a job, or there's a death in the family, or something that really threatens them. And they are able to stop, and they never drink again. And most of us know of people like that who used to drink but don't drink anymore. Then there's another type, a variation of that same type, who seem to be an alcoholic, but who have become physically addicted to alcohol as well as psychologically addicted. Physical addiction to alcohol, we forget that is not, doesn't happen to a lot of alcoholics, but when it happens to you, it's really bad news. It is much more difficult to get an addicted alcoholic off alcohol than it is a heroin addict off heroin. They die much more often. But anyway, these are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created. And they take them off medically step by step, and they point out to what's happened to their lives and how things are going bad. And by the time they get off out of that treatment center, they realize, my life is chaos, I quit! And they never drink again. And we know of people like that. In fact, there's a hospital up in Seattle, Washington, called Schick Shadell, who specializes in those type of alcoholics. And they truthfully say, we can cure your alcoholism in 14 days. Because they medically withdraw them, they point out their lives, and they quit. And they have long lists of names of people who have been able to do this. Then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by any way you measure it. They drink and raise hell and so on. And something really happens to threaten their security, loss of a job, loss of a family, death in the family, something that really threatens them, and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And these same type of people come out of treatment centers with tears of sobriety, with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks, tears of sobriety, but sincerity. And they realize what they've done to their lives, and they quit. But they always begin to drink again. And these are the people who have baffled science and medicine and institutions and the law and their own families as long as there's been alcohol. There's records of these people for thousands of years. And one time they thought they were possessed by devils. They put them to death because they didn't seem to respond to anything. And they'd flogged them and whipped them and sent them away to Australia from England. Get rid of them. Do something. Sounds funny, but it wasn't funny at all. And to this, in my lifetime, I'm kind of old, but I'm not as old as 5,000 years. In my lifetime, when I was a little boy, there was still no answer for these people anywhere in the world. Anywhere. They just were hidden, sent away, left to die. It's just amazing, just amazing. And these are the people, as I say, probably the worst, the people that they baffled worst were their own families. I'm sure there was hardly anyone in this room tonight who's an alcoholic who hasn't seen that terrible, as I have, seen that terrible look of disappointment and sadness on someone who loves you. And they say, oh, how could you? How could you? You promised. And the children were starting to feel a little better again, and I'll look at you. How could you? And it makes you feel terrible, so you have to say things. Oh, get off my back, God damn it. Leave me alone. Because you feel so bad, and I don't know why it is either. But these are alcoholics. And when Bill Wilson wrote this book about people like us, because this program was designed not for alcoholics, but for alcoholics like us, he again and again in the book refers to alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics of our type. He doesn't specify any other types, but he sensed that there was alcoholics who could not be helped. And he was one of them, and he knew there were a large number of them. And so all these years, there's never been any answer to it. And then as most of us know, in the beginning in 1930, there was a series of funny little coincidences that happened that for the first time in history enabled people like you and me to live with some degree of hope. This rich kid in New York was sent to Switzerland, and Dr. Jung worked on him. And some of you know this, but it's an interesting thing. A lot of people don't understand this. When Roland's family, this man, they wanted to help him, they found the best psychiatrist in the world. And they wrote to the best psychiatrist, said, "Would you treat our son?" And they wrote to Dr. Freud. And Dr. Freud refused to take the case. That's the first break we ever got. If he had taken the case, we might all be sitting here drunk, saying, "But I dreamt I was sober." But they couldn't get to Dr. Jung, so they got to Dr. Jung, and he treated this guy for a year, and the guy got drunk again. He refused to take him back. And he said, "What does this mean, doctor?" The doctor says, "It means that, as far as I know, you must keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily for the rest of your life. Otherwise, you almost certainly will drink till you die or go mad." That's the best doctor in the world. That's the only help he had for people like us. And he came back, and through a series of coincidences, he got something called the Oxford Movement. And he'd been so impressed by what the doctor said that he wrote later, "I wanted to stay sober as long as I could, so my parents would have a pleasant memory of me when I died drunk." And it sounds funny, except a few years later, his parents had a pleasant memory of him when he died drunk. But while he was sober, through a series of coincidences, his family sent him to Vermont to celebrate his newfound sobriety. He happened to get there just in time to keep a guy from going to the penitentiary, a guy named Ebby. And he brought him back to New York, and Ebby happened to think he was supposed to have to go find someone to tell about the Oxford Movement, and he happened to think of his friend Bill Wilson by coincidence and got a hold of Bill Wilson. And just a series of little funny things. If anything happened slightly differently, we wouldn't be here today. It's just amazing how these things happen. And Bill Wilson finally got the Oxford Movement, had some sort of a psychological upheaval. He called it a spiritual awakening, spiritual experience. And he got a job finally. He was a failed stockbroker. They sent him out to Akron, Ohio to do a deal, and the deal blew up in his face, and he almost got drunk. Standing in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, I stood there where he was standing. Years later, I kind of try to recreate the feeling. Got $10 in his pocket. He can either pay off the hotel or buy a train ticket home. Doesn't know what to do. And right over there in the corner is a little room, like right over there where those doors are, and over there's a little curved yellow sign saying cocktails. And he thought, if I had a drink or two, I could figure out what to do. And we all know that feeling. And he started. And if he'd have got there, we wouldn't have got here, I'll tell you. But he happened to see a telephone. He remember he promised he'd call somebody in the Oxford movement. He called somebody who accidentally got him in touch with some rich lady whose doctor was a drunk. And they got together and they talked about the spiritual values and how much they'd been trying to do things. And the doctor went off to the Medical Association convention in New York or in Atlantic City. When he got off the train coming home, they had to carry him off. He was so drunk. And our lives hung by a thread so thin you can't imagine. But then they did something. They realized something. They realized that sitting around discussing spiritual matters isn't what had kept Bill sober. He'd been trying to help people. So they thought, maybe that was it. We should try to help people. So they went to the hospital in Akron and tried to help a guy who became number three. And little by little, A grew. In very difficult times, most of the people in those early days got drunk. It was because they had a concept of, we just can give them some religion. And religion had not just what kept Bill sober, it was helping people. But as they helped people and little by little separated religion from spirituality, and there seems to be a difference, AA grew. And now, through a lot of vicissitudes and problems and getting bigger and almost expiring in the 1940s, and they had to write traditions to keep it together, and little by little grew. Now it's in 134 countries. There are over 2 million sober alcoholics, which, you know, is pretty remarkable. You stop to think that when I was a kid, there weren't any. There weren't any. Now there's 2 million. We have meetings everywhere. Probably the most sobriety in the world is in the United States, because that's where it started. And of all the, you know, in the United States, probably the hotbed of AA in the United States and the world is Southern California for some reason. But there are more sober alcoholics in Southern California than in New York and Illinois combined. It's just there's in our meeting list in Los Angeles, we have 3,000 meetings. I mean, can you imagine that? My home group in Los Angeles has a membership of over 1,000 every Wednesday night. And they're all excited. Some of you have been there. So you think, well, what Dr. Jung has said is not right. You have to keep yourself confined. You're going to be all right. Except there's one little cloud in the sky. I said there's AA kind of the center spot of AA in the world almost is Southern California. There are some people who think Akron is the heartbeat of AA because that's where AA started. Akron has the same relationship to AA that Bethlehem has to Christianity. Something nice happened there once, but not for a long time. Don't anybody tell anybody in Akron that, please. But in America, where there's AA everywhere, there isn't a town that I can think of without an AA group or people, and they travel around, and so the sobriety is available everywhere. It is estimated by the National Institute of Health, as of the most recent figures a couple years ago, that today over 90% of alcoholics of our type in America still die drunk or as a direct result of drinking. And you wonder, why would that be, for God's sakes? You don't have to stop drinking. There's places to go. It doesn't even cost anything. If you want professional help, go to some treatment center and get one of those $10,000 big books if you want to do that. But AA is everywhere. Why would this be? I'm in a situation different than most of you, I suppose. When I was sober a few years, I'd become fairly successful in life and working in radio and television and corporations. I, in some hideous fit of misjudgment, I left a job at a marketing in a publishing firm, and for the last few years I work in the middle of Skid Row, which is the bottom rung of the ladder. And when I go to work in the morning, I live out by the ocean, by the Pacific, and I get in the morning, I get in my car and drive downtown, and I pull over to where I work, and I have to get out of my car and have to step over the bodies of dying men, women, and children to get to my office. And when I go home, I work all day trying to do what I can and come home at night, step over the bodies of dying men and women and children. And you would think, gee, if you know so much about alcoholism, why don't you help these people? And I can't tell you, when I first went down there, and I have, from time to time since, I've really spent a lot of time trying to help these people. And most of them don't want to hear it, and they can't believe that the problem is what they think it is. And it made me so frustrating. Now, why can't you accept this? I got a way to go. I work with people that are staying sober, and you're dying, for God's sake. I'll tell you, the ability of alcoholics to deny their illness is incredible. I think about that. The Los Angeles County Charity Hospital, county hospital it's called, big, big hospital. If I went over to the cancer ward there, where these guys are dying of cancer, poverty-stricken people dying of cancer, I said, hey, got a deal. I've got a cure for cancer. It's going to work. It's worked for people. Does anybody here want it? They would beg you. They'd, please, please take me. Or go down a floor in one of the big AIDS wards in the world, charity AIDS wards. You walk in there, it's just like walking into hell. Not that it smells bad, but they're all going to be dead soon. Open sores are dreadful. And what do they say if I said, hey, I got an answer for AIDS. There's an answer now that'll help you save your life from AIDS. Anybody want it? They would crawl across the floor and lick your feet to try to get it. Jesus, give it to me. Give it to me. But month after month, we go down to the alcoholic ward where a guy's laying in a bed with his liver out to here. His skin is yellow. Not long to live. I'm not going to your goddamn AA meeting. I don't need that crap. And it's funny, except you come back next week and he's dead, and there's a new guy in the bed saying he is not an alcoholic. Now, if people hours almost away from death from alcoholism can still deny they're alcoholics, it's easy for any of us to do it, because we can all find the reason to prove we're not. And that's what makes it such a threatening and frightening disease. I try to work with these people, and I'll tell you, what really got to me finally was this. I was giving a guy help one day, and I suddenly realized, if sobriety could be conveyed by good intentions, by good wishes, by people trying to do the right thing, why did I slip in AA year after 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 year? The worst years of my life came after I had been exposed to AA and people were trying to help me on a yearly basis. And I started off as kind of a high-bottom drunk. And I worked down to being a medium-bottom drunk. And the last day I drank, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles and said, get the hell out of here, you stinking mooch. And I tried to explain, I'm not a mooch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote were running that very week in magazines. I've had my picture in the New York Times. But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside of that damn old mission. I had just had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix, Arizona jail. I'd lost in Arizona all my ID, all my clothes. A guy had given me a car to drive, and I'd lost the car, got drunk, got in a beef, got thrown in jail, and a guy in the jail kicked my teeth out because I vomited on his bunk. I had a terrible feeling. I've talked about it before, but the feeling, I'm sure there are people here who've had that feeling. When you suddenly realize there is no longer any friendly direction. It's all the same. Nobody wants to see you anywhere. That is really makes you gulp. And if a guy had come to me that morning and said, you've been playing around AA now, going to AA and leaving and laughing at it and ridiculing it and telling what a bunch of idiots they are, and now you're dying. Why wouldn't you go back to AA if he had said, at least admit you're an alcoholic? And I'd have to tell him, pal, because I'm not really an alcoholic. My case is different. The universal flag of everybody like me that dies from alcoholism, my case is different. I know I got problems. Jesus, I've had problems since I was a little boy. When I was a little boy, I recognized the fact that there seems to be something missing in me. And I don't know what it is. But I know when I get close to people, they don't seem to like me as well as they like other people, as far as I can tell. And I don't seem to fit in very well. And people, I don't feel comfortable. And the people I like to be with are people kind of above me, but they don't want to be with me. The people who want to be with me are the people kind of below me, and I don't want to be with them. And it's almost as though you go through life one way or another. If you're supposed to feel like this inside, it's always like this for some reason. Just nothing. Once in a while you feel okay, but pretty soon it goes back. Just always nothing quite right. Nothing quite. I think if I look back at my life, and for many, many years, I never even thought of this, but if I would say one phrase that was in my mind more than anything else, it would be just, this isn't it either. This isn't the woman. This isn't the job. This isn't the place. This isn't anything. And I didn't know how to explain that to people. These feelings are feelings of guilt, because I was raised in a very, very strong church, the Norwegian Lutheran Church, and I was not unable to live up to their standards as far as I could determine. I made the standards much higher. Kids have it. It's either perfect or nothing, you know. And my life has been spent missing goals. And so what I do to make up for it, I make the goals higher. screw it. To hell with it. Why even try? And I've spent thousands, when I got to be an adult, I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to discover why I had these feelings. And I discovered all kinds of reasons and made me feel better. Psychoanalysis, at least for people like me, is a strange thing, because I don't know, I always liked it. I don't know why I liked it, because all you ever find out is ways you've been hurt that you hadn't been aware of yet, you know. I found out I'd been terribly scarred by the Depression. I didn't even know there'd been a Depression. But once they explained it, I could see it. I'd been repressed by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. I didn't know that, but it really made me upset to hear it. A lot of things, you know. And it used to make me feel good. I mean, I'd lay there thinking, geez, really helping me. And I never could figure out why I would feel good about that till years later, when I was sober a number of years, maybe 25 years ago. Some guy came up to me that I was sponsoring and was telling me about a new therapy he had found that really made himself feel better. Something called Adult Children of Alcoholics. And I'd never heard of it at that time. He said, you want to go to a couple of meetings? I said, sure. So I went to a couple of meetings with him. And in the middle of the meeting, I could suddenly see how psychoanalysis had made me feel better. It had, because it was doing it to these people. And I'll tell you how they do it. I don't know if they intend to do it this way, but it does it for people like me. Of all the emotions I know, probably the worst emotion, continuing basis, is long-term, deep-seated guilt. Guilt of crappy things you've done, and sometimes even more sinister than that, things you didn't do that you should have, the sins of omission. I promised my grandmother I'd take care of it, and I didn't, and on and on and on. And just, and it's always, you can do whatever you want, but guilt is a bad thing. The only thing I ever knew to beat that feeling is drinking. It gets rid of it for a while. It gets rid of the scale. That's what drinking does for me. It gets rid of the damn scale. And now, what would you think of a therapy that would help you get rid of guilt? And that's apparently what Adult Children of Alcoholics did for these people, as psychoanalysis did for me. I'll tell you how you get rid of guilt. By convincing the patient that he or she is and has always been the victim. You are the victim. You've been hurt. You've not been loved the way you should have been loved. You've not been nurtured. The people you should have taken care of, you didn't. They may have tried to. You have had bad things happen to you. And little by little, you realize, I'm a victim. And when I become a victim, it's no longer my fault. It's their fault. I'm just what they created. I'm a victim. And it really, I tell you, you go to those meetings, there's no laughter in those meetings. They talk about resentments, and they talk about sadness, and it's tough, tough life. And they, well, what's wrong with that? At least you get rid of guilt. Because I'll tell you, what you find out something, there are no free lunches in the world. There are no free lunches. And Now, I'm not attacking adult children with alcoholism. I'm just talking about my reaction, what I've seen in myself. There are no free lunches. And to get rid of guilt that way, through victimization, there's little price tags you pay. You don't even see the price tags, but you can see them in retrospect. And I could see it in psychoanalysis, the price tags I paid, although I wasn't aware of it. First of all, whether you intend to or not, you must build, sustain, and enhance resentment. Resentment to those who failed you. Resentment to those who didn't love you, who didn't take care of you. You had a lot of resentments in those types of therapies. People sit around and share the resentment. The second little price tag you pay is that you must accept the fact that you have been made terminally different, and you're never going to, you can't change. I heard one of the guys say one time, one of their gurus, he said, "We are like trees in a forest. When we were saplings, someone reached within us and ripped out our hearts. And we continue to grow, and we look like all other trees, but we are empty inside, and nothing can ever change it." And so now you know you're different, and you're always going to be different. And the third little price tag you pay, of course, is that if you're like me, intermittent but intense self-pity. I could have been something, by God. I'll tell you, the line that I ever saw in literature, in the movie On the Waterfront, this half-punch-drunk fighter sits in the back seat with his brother, the gangster, and says, "Jesus, Jimmy, you should have taken care of me. I could have been a contender." You know, that's a touching, always touched my heart. And you think, well, these are inconveniences, but maybe it's worth it to get rid of guilt. Guilt makes you commit suicide. These things don't make you commit suicide. They just make you feel bad. And maybe they are for most people. But for people like me who suffer from this particular form of alcoholism, it's an interesting thing. You look at the book Alcoholics Anonymous, written for people like us, and it lists the three most lethal emotions for alcoholics. Number one, resentment. Number two, feelings of difference. Number three, self-pity. And why are they so lethal? Because they will justify every drink I take till I die from it. And it will never have been my fault. And you don't understand. And it sounds kind of funny, except when you're in the middle of it. It isn't hardly funny at all. But I knew there was something wrong with me. And I read books. My greatest thing that ever happened to me is when I was 15, I was kind of a screwed up kid. I ran away to the beginning of the war. And I got in the Merchant Navy. Should never allowed me in, but they're crying for men. And on one of those ships, I got a guy showed me how to drink, and I drank a little bit, and it made the scale go away. I didn't know it then; it just made me feel like something. And I didn't become a terrible alcoholic, but that alcohol in my life, I say it again and again, alcohol is the best friend I ever had. Friends come and go, lovers come and go. Jobs come and go, cities come and go, states come and go. But when a few drinks is making that scale go away and making you feel like something, boy, no matter where you are, that's something. And of course, I have a little trouble with it sometimes. And I don't like the trouble. I don't like being arrested. I've been arrested. I have a particular form of difficulty. When I get to a certain amount of drinking sometimes, I have an absolute need to counsel police officers. God damn it. You would think that you'd remember what happened the last time you did it. I'm going to tell you, pal, I'm your boss. I'm a citizen. So I've been to jail overnight a lot of times. But it's an interesting thing. We were talking the other night in Newbridge. You know, if you ever get a chance, Newbridge has got a great little group there. It's a very pocket of enthusiasm. And not only that, but you no longer have to seek lower companions. They're there waiting for you. Not really, really good group. But we're talking about this, about how chapter three is such a, you know, you read the book and just blah, 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 blah. If you stay around a while, the book gets smarter and smarter and smarter as the years go by. And one of the smartest places in that book is the first page or so of chapter 3, where they talk about people like us who feel so different and wonder what we have in common with other people. And one of the things, after you're sober a while, you can look back and say, well, that's it. That's one of the things I should have recognized that I didn't. But people of our type, somewhere along the line, must and do accept the obsession that someday, somewhere, I will find a way to control and enjoy my drinking. And people say, why do you worry so much about your drinking? I don't know, but I'm going to find a way. Why would you want to have to find a way? Because for people like me, I can't live like that. It's too unpleasant and uncomfortable. And when I drink, it's not that way. And I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler, and I'm going to find a way to do it. And they have that funny little paragraph in there that sometimes people laugh at, but they're not funny at all. Drinking wine, always drinking at home, try never drinking at home, try to get physical exercise, read spiritual literature, drink beer only, change from one kind of booze to another, all the things you do, trying to find the formula, and sooner or later you always go down again. Occasional brief recoveries, followed always by still worse relapse, till you get to that stage of, God, what a testy, touching little thing, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You think, that's how drunk you get. That is not how drunk you get at all. That's how you feel after you sober up. Pitiful and because they want answers and I got no answers and I'm just as baffled as anybody. Leave me alone! And next time it'll be different. I'll quit drinking. That's what I'll do. I'll quit drinking. One day, I'll watch it this time. Because drinking makes good times better and bad times good. That's all. That's why I drink. I'm not a drinker. I'm a feeler. And you don't understand, so to hell with you. When I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949, that's a long time ago, I was 22 and I'd had, after I'd been in the Merchant Navy for a while, I went to the United States Navy and I was at the end of the war, I was in the Naval Hospital. I'd been sewed together and they passed around some tests. I did very well in the tests, so they gave me a high school diploma because I never graduated from high school. And I went to college after the war and went out in the world, became a sports writer. And all these years I drank heavily and had carouse that the young guys can do. And I was having some problems getting in beefs, and so somebody suggested I go to this thing called AA, because this was a new thing in town, and some of the old town drunks were even cutting down on their drinking. But I remember going in there, and I was 22. I didn't know there wasn't anybody within 20 years of that whole state yet. And I remember the guy looking at me and said, what the hell are you doing here? They told me to come. You think you're an alcoholic? No, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. So what do you think? What's wrong with you? I tried to be honest. I think I'm too sensitive. I never told anybody that for a long time. But that's an interesting phenomenon, too, because in those days, there weren't any young people. Now there's a lot of young people in AA. And you wonder, how could it be young people in AA? How could these old people be around? And it turns out it isn't how long you drank. It's when it begins to have that special effect for you. But you can sit in a meeting and some old guy get up and say, I drank for 40 years. And he looks in the front row and there's some little kid about 22. And he said, as if to say, how can you be an alcoholic, you little puke? I drank longer than you've been alive. And he doesn't know the little puke is looking at him thinking, if you're any kind of an alcoholic, how did you last 40 years, you old son of a bitch? It turns out it isn't how long you drink. It's when it begins to make the scale go away, to do that special effect, when you need it to fill a hole. And I stood in a street corner in Los Angeles. I was an old man. I was 31, but I was an old man. My life was behind me. Wife and children gone. Life gone. Occupation gone. Career gone. I'd never get another job, they told me, because I'd screwed up so many bad times. And I would have bet my life. A guy could have put a lie detector in my arm and said, are you an alcoholic? I said, not really. Because I knew what an alcoholic was. If you're new tonight, you already know what an alcoholic is. Alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol. You come to AA and admit your problem is alcohol, and then you feel better and you return to God and you live happily ever after. Or happier anyway. And I knew that wasn't for me, because my problem is not alcohol. And if God exists, I am damned. So I cannot ever return to God. You talk about God if you want it, but don't tell me about it. And it doesn't work for people like me. That's why I'm not an alcoholic. So that's why it's kind of strange to find myself standing here tonight. I've come here at tremendous expense and no little inconvenience. So I can stand here and say a strange thing happened to me. And, next week it'll be 46 years since I stood in that street corner in the rain. And I would have bet my life that day and thereafter there was no help for me. And I knew more about AA than the people who were trying to help me. I'd read the book and I'd been to meetings and all these idiots. And turn it over. Keep it green. Remember when you are not alone. No, but I'm going to be soon. So I just for a few minutes want to talk tonight a little bit about what changed my life. Maybe it'll help somebody here. Maybe it won't. Who cares? I'll be gone tomorrow. Not really, but it makes me sound tough to. I walked off that street because I had to get out of the rain. My mouth was bleeding from the teeth being out, and I walked 72 blocks in the rain to an AA club where I was going to try to hustle some money. And I had a little bad luck there, and I wound up sleeping in an abandoned car in the AA club parking lot and going to meetings in this damn club where all these had these signs all up and those hideous steps again. If you are like me, I'll tell you, the first three steps of AA can keep you out of AA till you die. I mean, if you're like me, feelings and sensitive and misunderstood and hurt and self-pitying, how are you going to overcome it? You're going to admit that your problem is alcohol and therefore your life is screwed up. Then you're going to return to God. He's going to make you sane. Then you're going to turn your life over to God. Hooray, hooray. Shit. That doesn't work for people who are cursed with the ability to think. Well, I hung around this club for a while, and I was getting tired of it. Now, I often, you know, I used to thought, what a series of funny little things that had to happen for me to be here. I used to see a movie actor came into the meetings, and I now know that he was not a very good movie actor. I've been in more movies in the last few years than he ever was, but I didn't know that at the time. And if he was a movie actor, I knew he had to be having some wealth somewhere. And these old guys were saying to me, I was just trying to stay in this club. It rained day after day, and I stayed in there to get out of the rain and hustled a little bit, but I could. But they said, get a sponsor. That's the trouble with these activist groups. They want to get a sponsor. So I thought, I'll get this movie actor, and we'll share his fame and fortune. And I'll set him up. I'll get some teeth. I'll get some clothes. I'll go back to New York. I'll be sober. My eyes are clear. I'll say, well, yes, I used to drink and have troubles, but now I've learned my lesson. Give me a job on probation. I'll work for nothing till you see what I can do. I'll do a wonderful job. I'll make some money. I'll come back to Los Angeles one day. I'll come to this club. I'll buy this club, and I'll burn her down. You know, not much of a motive, really, for sobriety, but enough. So I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and he said, yeah, but I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. And I found out later he didn't like me. I found out he really didn't like me. It made me feel bad at first, but I realized now he shouldn't have liked me. I was the worst type of newcomer that ever comes to AA. And that is a long-term slipper who already knows all about AA. God, they're a sickening bunch. I've had a few of them. You know. I think you're misquoting the book there, aren't you? And God has given me two or three of those in the last few years to punish me for being my bad behavior. But But he tried to help me. He'd take me with him a couple times to hear him talk, and he'd talk to me. I heard him say something along the line that it seemed so odd to me. He said something, I heard him tell somebody, he said, you know, as long as you think your problem is alcohol, you're going to die drunk. Huh? On the way home, I thought, what the hell is that about, Bob? He said, well, that's, you know, a lot of people think their problem is alcohol, and they have a lot of problems. I said, oh, what is the problem, Bob? Too much white flour, for Christ's sake? What is it? You know? He said, no, look. And over the next few days, he gave me an explanation off and on. Gave me long lectures about how, you know, if your problem is alcohol, you're wasting your time going to AA. AA doesn't, can't help people like you. You have no problem. Well, what is the problem? He said, no, there's an answer for people with an alcohol. I said, what is the answer, Bob? He said, you quit drinking. I said, that's stupid. That's stupid. I've done that 100 times. It doesn't work. He said, that's right. That's because your problem isn't alcohol, apparently. You have something else. Something that sounds like alcohol that may kill you. I said, what is it, Bob? He said, it's something called alcoholism. I said, oh, my God. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm a smart guy. Alcohol, alcoholism. And he spent a lot of time explaining the difference, but it could be synthesized in one sentence that I would think was the cornerstone of my life, really. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. Apparently, there are some types of alcoholics who can do that. But in this particular form of alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob. If alcohol does that bad thing to you, why do people drink it then? He said, that's the whole point, kid. People think alcohol does something bad for them. That's way down the road. That isn't what makes alcoholics. People never seem to understand around here. What makes an alcoholic is that alcohol, the special effect is, it has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. And you don't even know it, that it's almost instantly changing your perception of reality as soon as you drink. It changes your relationship to the world around you. It makes me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less frightening. I remember thinking, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He says, because it isn't really happening, kid. You're just fantasizing now, and you're out of step with everybody. And also set up that damn thing called the phenomenon of craving for people like us. I don't understand it. Nobody else does, but it sets it up. And, you know, there never has been an adequate explanation of the phenomenon of craving. But I have a theory for me, at least for people like me, maybe like some of you, I don't know, but like for me is this. When I drink, the scale goes away and I start to do good. And almost instantly, it starts to come back a little bit. Give me another one, Fred. Without even being aware of it, I'm trying to hold this technicolor. I'm trying to hold this. I don't want to go back there. Come on, give me another one. Just instinctively, pretty soon you're drunk and it's all gone anyway. But I'm trying to hold that what I'm drinking for. And he says, eventually, you kid, you got to get drunk. Then you got to get sober. Well, Jesus, I said, if it's doing that to you, and you get in trouble, why would you ever drink again? Why would you ever drink? Why did God just say, I don't drink anymore? He says, that's the other end of the coin, kid. And he had a theory that I read about, it indicates a little bit of it in the book, but I certainly believe this to be true. I thought he was way ahead of his time. He said, when human beings grow up, all of us grow up physically, We have to learn to live in the world. We learn the conflicts and problems and good things and bad things and what we can handle and what we can't handle and what we have to give things to get things, and you have to give and take it on. The process is called maturing, going from children to adulthood. Mature people live rather comfortable lives because they don't get involved in every big deal. Things are not big deals. They see them in perspective going along, and it's really not so bad. He said, but unfortunately, people like us don't have to go through that process. When we get to a problem and it's really painful, I have a few drinks and get rid of it. Screw you, beneficial finance. And I wind up with a lot of unresolved problems, but I sneak through. But the day comes I have to stop drinking, I never had the slightest idea that they're there waiting for me. And I never met anybody who knew that. Because I stand there, grown up body, grown up brain, grown up ability, grown up strength, grown up verbal skills, and never once even guessing that I'm at the intermittent beck and call of childish emotions. We call them alcoholic emotions because it sounds a little bit nicer. Yes, I guess I have alcoholic emotions. But they're childish. What are alcoholic emotions? I love you. I hate you. You hurt my feelings. I'm going to run away. Will you marry me? And pretty soon you're just in a childish mood. And you got to get a little relief, so you have to have a few little drinks. And you drink till you have to stay sober. Then you stay sober till you have to drink. Then you drink till you have to stay sober. And every time back and forth, your mind will tell you, you see, the problem is not really alcohol. It's all these other things. They don't understand, and they're not taking good care of you anyway. They don't give you the love and what you need, and if you could only get a break, you'd be all right. And they don't understand. Have a few drinks and watch it this time. And the thing goes on. I said, Jesus, Bob, that describes me almost exactly. He said, there's a name for people like you. I thought, uh-oh. What is it, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I remember thinking, well, I'll be damned. I've just spent 10 years of my life throwing away everything I had, have no chance to ever be anything again, because I never once heard a description of what was wrong with me like that. I heard obsession of the mind and allergy of the body and all these crazy things. That I said, Bob, why don't they put that in AA and describe it the way you describe it? He said, they do, kid. It's in the first step. You admit you're having problems with alcohol, dash, which means end of thought, beginning of new thought, and you admit you're having problems without alcohol. And I guess that was in January of 1959. And I came to believe I was an alcoholic that day, and I since that day I've never really had a strong desire to drink alcohol. And you may think, isn't that wonderful? His life turned out just perfect. Not at all. My life was terrible because I still had bad attitudes and a bad mouth and a bad couldn't get along. And you think, why wouldn't you drink? Because all those years I was sitting in AA meetings smirking to get the heat off from some job or something, I'd hear these idiots come in and talk about their slips and how bad they were and how terrible. And their friend went on a slip and hanged himself, and somebody else shot himself, and they lost everything. I thought, Jesus, it's so bad now, I can't afford anything worse. I'm not going to slip. I will give myself permission to commit suicide if necessary, but I will not slip. And a couple times I almost committed suicide. Once I was walking towards the ocean and drowned myself. I'm just hopeless, but I never did. And little by little, I stayed sober. Then they started in me a little bit, well, when are you going to work? When are you going to go work the next step? And I had to tell Bob, don't start in me about that. I cannot return to God. Maybe you can argue for now till next Christmas, but I cannot, because I was raised to believe in God. I know about God. I mean, I hear people say, I've been searching for God for 30 years. I've known where God lived since I was 2 years old. He slowly circles the Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gives it to sinners. and he gives it to Catholics. I'm a sinner and I married a Catholic. What chance do I got? But I could joke about it, but it wasn't funny at all, because I knew that I was damned. If God exists, I am damned. And I can all day long talk about it philosophically, laugh about it, but when you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you can't sleep and you know it's true, they're going to get you. You're going to burn, you son of a bitch. You're going to burn. And he said, well, he never says you have to return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself? Is that somebody else, Bob? Do they live down the street here? He says, no, it doesn't say that either. And I hate your attitude. He used to say that. His other favorite explanation to me was, shut up. Thank you, Bob. I didn't think of it that way. But he says, the step doesn't say that. It says you got to come to believe in something. You never return to anything in AA, because you'd have to go back to sick perceptions to do that. Don't talk about returning to things. Come to believe in something. It may be the same thing you believed in before, but you believe in it differently. Can't you come to believe in God? I said, no, I can't, Bob. He says, can't you believe in AA? I said, no. Too religious for people like me. Some of it's good, but I'm that religious that I can't handle. He says, do you think I'm doing better than you are? Said, of course you are. He says, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. People in the club would laugh. You know, I mean, I could accept that. He could not send me to hell. He tried, but he couldn't. And people around the club would say, there's that crazy bastard thinks his sponsor's God. I knew he wasn't God. But over a period of time, he had talked to me a lot. And what happened was this. What happened was this. Something slowly happened, although looking back, I can see it. I began to feel, this guy seems to know how I feel. I had never believed anybody knew how I felt. We were talking today about when you were having a bad time and you didn't believe anybody knew how you felt. And a lot of us have had that feeling. I know you mean well, but we've all been getting advice advice to last us 10,000 years. Here's what you should do. Here's what you should do. Teachers, ministers, parents, friends, everybody. And you just after a while know, yeah, you nod, but you don't know what the hell you're talking about. But if you can find someone who you believe knows how you feel, a phenomenon happens. That advice turns into meaningful information. And I can take actions, because even though I don't agree with them or believe in it, if I think the best thing I could offer any newcomer, I hope you find someone that you will believe knows how you feel. It will save your life, I'll guarantee you. But anyway, what's this step going to do? Going to restore me, come to believe that this power is going to do what? Restore me to sanity? What the hell does that mean? What is sanity? You can read 10 books on psychoanalysis or psychiatry, and you get 10 different definitions of sanity. But oddly enough, it's quite easy to define insanity. Not alcoholic insanity, but psychosis. Psychosis, this is really an oversimplification, but it really is basically it. When the human mind is under great pressure, under great strain, and can't stand looking for some kind of an answer, and can't find an answer, in the last gasp, it will make reality look differently than it is to relieve the pressure. That's what psychosis is. Many people, it's just a little bit. Some people, it's a lot of it. For example, now it sounds funny, but it isn't funny. For example, what are these people doing? What are they always doing? Ah, they're talking about me and trying to kill me. That relieves the pressure. I know why they're doing this now, because they're trying to kill me. And a form of paranoia, but all sorts, there's all variations of it, all kinds of things. Of thinking you're someone else briefly, going into a different personality, anything for the mind to get some relief from that conflict. Now here's an interesting... Give her allowance and send her home. Don't give her allowance. What the hell with that? Here's a funny phenomenon. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that odd? Cases of alcoholics becoming psychotic are as rare as anything. You'd think that'd be a number one thing. We talk about psychosis. Alcoholics that die from insanity used to be only behind syphilis. Now we've overtaken syphilis as a cause of insanity. What do you mean they don't become psychotic? Alcoholic insanity, as we've talked about before, is not psychosis. That is when you drink sufficient alcohol to dehydrate your body enough so that your brain dries out. What we call a wet brain is a dried out brain. If it seems strange, I'll explain it to you after the meeting, but a dried out brain. Korsakoff syndrome is called. And these people aren't acting silly in meetings. They're sitting in a bed somewhere and they change their diapers three times a day and feed them. And they sit like that for 40 or 50 years, never have known what their names are. That's what alcoholic insanity is. But alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Why not? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, they drink alcohol. So what's the big deal about that? The reaction of alcohol in them is to make reality look different. What if these other people who become psychotic drink alcohol? They do, but it doesn't change their perception of reality. I and you have the ability, believe it or not, to temporarily induce psychosis. Things look different. And we joke about it, but it's really true. Example I used the other night. Can you imagine anything else in the world? Take a depressed, broken guy thinking about suicide, maybe just desperate. Go to a bar. God damn it, give me a couple of drinks. And 15 minutes later, you're sidling down the bar saying things like, "You with anyone, Granny?" Things look different. And if you're lucky, she'll say, "Yes, she is with someone." I don't know where I said this, someplace. But explain what coyote ugly is. You know what coyote ugly is? That's an old joke among drinkers in where I live. That is when you wake up in the morning and you feel someone's head on your arm. And then, like a coyote, you will gnaw off your arm rather than wake her up. But that comes under the heading of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. So apparently, what I had to accept this, not everybody has to accept this, but the way I accepted it was this. I have to come to believe. Now, the great thing about this, if you do, you don't have to understand how it's going to happen. That is not in here at all. Just that it can happen. You got to believe that the people didn't all get together to lie to you. I got to, in the second step, come to believe there's a power here that will enable me to live in sustained reality without inducing psychosis to handle it. And I could accept that as the second step. And I said, "But I don't know how it's going to happen, Bob." She said, "That comes a long time from now. You just believe it can happen because I said it did." And that's right. And as a result of that, I did things he told me, took actions. And if you're new, they really, sponsors sometimes tell you to do the dumbest damn things. You just wonder what the hell they're thinking about. I mean, they don't actually say this, but it sounds as dumb as this, as if you look at that wall and say, "See that wall? That wall is bright red. I see it more like a brown, Bob. I tell you it's red." "Well, goddamn it, you act like it's red." Now, they don't tell you about the color of walls, because that's too easy, but they tell you things equally stupid. "I don't care how it looks to you. You go and apologize to that woman. You called her a bitch." "But, Bob, she said terrible things to me, and she hurt my feelings, and she told her baby not to talk to me." "I don't care. You go and apologize." "Sorry." "Bitch." I don't care how it looks to you. Don't quit that job. It's a crappy job. It's the best job you're going to get for a long time. Hang on to it. Hang on to it. I don't care how it looks to you. You go to that meeting. But they never call on me. It's just a big click, and they treat me like a bunch of crap. Maybe you are. Go to the meeting. And the interesting thing about AA is this. When you begin taking the actions, you start to get better. It doesn't seem to make much difference whether you're a clean-cut, wonderful young man or woman just coming to find a new life, or whether you're a toothless, phony, old, imitation, intellectual puke living in the backseat of an abandoned car. Once you take the actions, things start to get better. And little by little, I was able to hold a job, and not much of a job, but I held a job, and I finally got a little job as a writer in a medical corporation. I was 2 years sober, still didn't have any front teeth. Had to learn to go to work like this every morning. They just thought I'd been burned in the fire. But I went to work every day, and I had to talk to my sponsor because I could not get along with people. I got a terribly smart mouth. I'm so cute. It just makes people crazy. And I had to call him a lot, and he gave me, and I didn't really learn much, but he taught me some great lessons in those next 3 years that I think are the greatest lessons I've lived as far as living in the world. Some great lessons. Now, they're not in the book, and they're not in our literature. But if you're new, I'll guarantee you, if you do this, you'll do better. Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back, children, employees, waiters and waitresses. On days you know you're having a bad day, watch that mouth, because you can cut people up and never know what the hell happened. When you're having a bad day, keep your mouth shut and just go around your life saying, "Come on, midnight. Jeez." Because once you start talking, you're going to hurt yourself. And he gave me some other stupid things, too, that I wouldn't even recommend. When you're going through a market and you see a can laying on the floor, stop and put it back in the shelf. You know, things like that. But those things, and so by the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that corporation. I had front teeth then. I smiled a lot. If there's anybody new here who's lost some teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. Ask your sponsor about that one. When I was 7 years sober, I was down on radio and television, and 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for an oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. And when I was 5 years sober, the same wife, Catholic wife, and all those children that I had, because you have a lot of children when you marry a Catholic. Heard the crinkle of green in my wallet down in Dallas, Texas, and moved out to Los Angeles, and we all got together again, and 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Then I got a book on the rhythm system, ended all that. And they've all grown up. Three of my daughters turned 15 this year in AA. And only one of my other kids aren't alcoholics, so I guess they didn't. But only one of my children has turned out bad. My oldest daughter has become a judge. I had so hoped for a defense attorney or a public defender, but no. She comes home at Christmas, she says, "Daddy, remember when we were little girls who used to get upset and send us to our room?" I said, "Sure, honey." She said, "When you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room." She doesn't scare me. I'm not going to Albuquerque. But isn't that nice? And when I was 15 years sober, I quit my job in this big marketing firm. And for the last 30 years, I run the Skid Row mission that threw me out in 1958. I'm still looking for those two guys that did it. Once I find them, it's an amazing thing. But I'm going home tomorrow, Monday morning. All of this will be a memory. I'll be step out of my car, and I'll be stepping over the bodies of men and women. Some will still be alive from the last time I was there a week ago, and some of them won't. Because they will not. I'll tell you, you wonder why alcoholics cannot stay sober. Why they cannot? Why, if God loves us all, well, I could not go for God. I had to have AA. Let me go back up just a little bit. My sponsor was my higher power, and I did things to please him. The third step, that's just too ridiculous. That is the, you know, that's nice for religious people, not for people like me. When I was about 6 months sober, I lost a job as a dishwasher after about 2 days because I had deduced that the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out to punish me because I was not a Mexican. That's what I thought at that time. And I got fired, and I started, that's the day I was going to kill myself. I was going to walk to the ocean, just forget it. You know? And I couldn't find the ocean. I called up my sponsor finally. And I said, Bob, you know, I know you tried to help me, and I know I've done pretty good some days, but I'm 6 months sober. People around me that I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn 5 years ago, they're all got jobs and doing well, and I'm smarter than they are, and I'm better than they are, and I can't even hold a job washing dishes. What the hell is... I'm just going to pack it in, Bob. AA is not enough for me. What can I do? He said, why don't you write your inventory the way I told you? And I said, I just told him a week before, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why do I want to take it with an out-of-work actor? What the hell is he going to do? Cut? Is that where you... Baloney. But I didn't want to say it again. And I was back sleeping on an abandoned car again briefly because I couldn't pay my rent. And I said, Bob, you don't understand. In my judgment, that's the last thing in the world I need. My God, more digging up this crap and dirt. And I'm so depressed now. I'm so guilt-ridden and feel so terrible. In my judgment, I need something a lot more than a damn inventory. And he said, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. You're a loser. You're a loser. I came out of that, and I turned. If I'd have turned right, I'd have got to the ocean, boy. And I turned. I got to the club. I said, Sullivan, give me some paper. I'm going to write my inventory. And I wrote. I put in terrible, the rottenest things I could think. Things I'd never tell my psychiatrist. Dirty, rotten. Somebody says, why don't you tell your psychiatrist these things? And the reason is, of course, when you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why you don't tell your psychiatrist. I don't want some little wussy to say to me, you did what, sir? Get out of my office. But first, wash off that chair. But I wrote this all crapped on and just, oh, I'm so glad to get out of my system. Just, oh. I jammed it under the back seat of that abandoned car, and a couple days later, he comes by this car and says, okay, Clancy, let's get in. I said, we're going to be meeting. He says, no, we're going to take your fifth step. I said, Bob, not today. I don't feel up to it. Jeez, I've got a lot of... shut up, he explained. I got in the car, and we went from Los Angeles to Oxnard, about 40 miles. He gave me a flashlight, and I read this thing. And it even read worse than I remembered. Oh, I am an unsavory person. I thought, he's going to make me walk back 40 miles. I thought, well, that's all, Bob. He says, you done now? He leaned over and says, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. But I've taken that trip over 200 times since then, in the last 40-some years, on the driver's side and some other goof over there with the flashlight. And, let me explain this part before I read it. And I'll tell you an amazing thing. At that level, when you get to writing an inventory, you begin to understand we are all the same. The same things are in every good inventory. Lack of self-worth, resentment, feelings of sadness, loneliness, feelings of being deprived, all the things that go to make up a personality like ours that enable us to have to drink to stand it. And there are never... In one week, a few years ago, I heard a daughter of one of the most famous men of the 20th century, and a guy who was born under a bridge in El Paso never knew who his father was. And she lived in a penthouse, he was in a rehab, and their emotions were the same. Much different specifics, but it's always the same. And it's that way all over the world that's what makes alcoholics so unusual. You have to be here a while and do a lot of things before you get to a level where you realize, my God, I'm like everybody else. And these are the battles we're fighting. But the point I want to make is this. The day I wrote that inventory and then took my fifth step, I believe, is the day I took the third step. Because that's what the third step is. Doing the things they ask of you. Turning your life and your will over to the care of God as you understand it, whatever that power may be. Usually who speaks through sponsors. And I think the first three steps have been the most wonderful thing in my life. I didn't think so, but I look back, they changed my life. And you say, well, you're sober a long time now. You know, why don't you get rid of those first three steps? And a lot of the steps, I don't take an inventory of you or anything else. But every once in a while, I get carried away with my own BS, or I feel a little depressed, something. And to me, the first three steps to this day are still kind of a trampoline. No matter how far down you're going, you remember, what am I doing here? Well, I can't drink, and of myself, I can't stay sober. And there's a power here that'll change it. So I better do it. Then you start to feel better again, and again and again. So the first three steps really were remarkable in my life. And over a period of time, I have not become a wonderful person. I sometimes hear people who just have become so wonderful and just, oh, I no longer have rage. I no longer have anger. I do. I don't like to. I mean, but the one thing, for example, that A has taught me, if someone's really abusing me on the freeway, cutting me off, I no longer have to chase them past my exit. If I haven't caught him by 4th Street, good flying, Red Baron, we'll meet again. But that's why they say dumb things like the don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Why? Because they affect my emotions, and my emotions affect my perception. When I'm hungry, I stay the same, but everybody else gets slow and stupid. You know? Come on, let's go! When I'm angry, God wants me to kill them for their own good. You try not to, but I mean you want to. When you're lonely, you know they're all somewhere, probably at a party, but they didn't tell you, did they? When you're tired, they attack you. They attack you on the freeway. A few years ago, I was coming off the freeway, and a little girl cut me off and almost killed me. I mean, it was that close. I drove like an Al Unser to get out of that one. And I made a special exception in her case. I'm going to follow her past my exit. Now, the trouble is in AA, when you are chasing people, when you do catch them, you can't really cut them off because you're not supposed to do that. But you can give them a ray. You know, give them a... And I chased this girl up the Pasadena Freeway, and I was going to give her a quadruple ray. And I got next to her. And I said to her, she was about 17 years old. Long blonde hair, just a sweet little girl, just the age of one of my granddaughters, Katie Doherty. I thought, what kind of a guy have I turned into? Chasing this little girl, probably learning to drive and doing the best she can. And I smiled. And she went. But that's what it's like out there, folks. That's why you got to take care of yourself. That's why you keep going to meetings. Not because you're going to learn anything, but it gets those memories. Because the actions of AA, let me just close by saying this. What do you do about the damn scale? We come here with a scale like this, and these AAs say things like, oh, don't worry about that side with the big black thing on it. Again, we're going to work on this side. There's nothing wrong with this side. It's that side. Oh, don't worry about it. Give you a little bucket of actions and a little spoon. Just take these little actions and put in these. This is stupid. But you do it a while, and pretty sure that scale starts to move. I'm feeling wonderful. Hey, it works. It's wonderful. But through some celestial prank, there's a tiny hole over here you never see. And every time you just get that baby there, oh, I found a new life, and it's, oh, Jesus Christ, what is this? Because on this side, that thing, whatever that is, you never get rid of that. And if you don't believe it, just stop doing the things for a while, and you'll see, right, you're down there again. And that's why it isn't that you have to do bad things. If you get bad things, you'll get drunk. No, if you don't take the actions the good things, you will get drunk. That is what makes you stay here. Left to our own, my own devices, I'm like this. And I can make it like this. And I can't ever do it perfectly, but I can try. I mentioned this the other night, but I don't know a better way to say it. First of all, let me say one thing. I want to thank Sally very much for being my host. And she's always been very gracious to me and treated me better than I deserve. And I try to be mean to her, and she smiles and takes it. And I see some old friends here and some new friends. And tomorrow morning I'll be up early and have to catch a plane to Los Angeles, because I got to be in Los Angeles tomorrow afternoon. But I want to thank all of you for being very gracious to me, and thank my friends from Newbridge, my friends from Belfast. And I've been very sick this week. I had to go to the doctor, and I thought I was going to die, and they pulled me through that. So I really had to go. I really feel excellent tonight. Looking forward to going back to my home and going to work Monday morning. But if you're new and you wonder what you're going to get out of this, you're going to just stay dry for 46 years like I did? No. Being dry would never, you can't do that. The purpose of AA, I believe, and I believe this with all my soul, the reason you take these actions is that because AA is designed to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. That's all. It is very slowly designed to change my perception of reality, to make the same things look different, to make the same emotions go away, to little by little make me taller and more secure inside of me and them less threatening to me, to change my relationship to the world around me. And I heard a guy say this once when I was new, and I thought it was the corniest thing I ever heard. But I'll tell you, as my closing tonight, I'll tell you what I think it is. Everything I know and believe can be encompassed in this. My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic, much to my surprise. And through the grace of God that I found after I was sober a while and my sponsor died and I kept taking actions, I came to believe in AA, and finally I got a sponsor who convinced me to pray wouldn't hurt me. And I don't know if God, what he thinks about me at all, but I know that he loves me. He loves me the same as you, no more, no less, or else he wouldn't be God. And he is not angry, he's not trying to punish me. He hopes that I'll do better, I guess. But my name is Clancy Ebers. I'm an alcoholic. Through the grace of God and the power of this program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating or tranquilizing medications of any kind since October the 31st, 1958. And for this, I am truly grateful, and I thank you.